Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. So my guest today has an extraordinary investing pedigree. He's been referred to as the godfather of emerging markets and was named as one of the 50 most influential people in 2011. Recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award in Asset Management, author of several books, he served on the World Bank's Global Corporate Governance Forum and has dodged bullets during a military coup whilst in the Philippines, and managed $40 billion for Templeton Asset Management, and in 2018 started Mobius Capital Partners. Mark, welcome today to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
Mark, I've been investing for 35 years. I have to say, this is a real thrill and an immense pleasure to have you here. So I'm very intrigued about lots of things. And maybe we could start with your early days. I believe you were born in New York to German and Puerto Rican parents, which is an exotic combination. So how did that shape your upbringing?
Oh, it had a tremendous impact because these people coming from the old world, particularly my father, German, and even my mother being of Spanish background, these people were much more conservative than our neighbors in America. Although at that time, Americans were not so much in debt as they are now. But I remember they never borrowed any money, paid everything in cash. And I acquired that financial conservatism from them. And it's really served me very well over the years.
And so you go to study at Boston University, where I believe you get both a master's and a postgraduate degree, and you get a PhD in economics from MIT. Now, were these degrees part of your master plan to end up in finance?
I tell you frankly, I started out with a Methodist scholarship to go to Boston University to study fine arts. So I was studying painting, drawing, theater, TV production, the whole gamut of arts. And then I moved on to a master's degree program at the School of Public Communications, which basically PR and all the rest of that sort of thing. Then I went to University of Wisconsin at their School of Journalism, which again was in line with mass communications, then got a scholarship to study in Japan, which really changed my life. That's really what set me on the road that I'm on now, because I decided at that time to live and work in Asia. But then I returned to America to finish studies at University of New Mexico, where I studied experimental psychology. Then it was MIT for economics and political science.
So I just want to pause on that Japanese experience, because this was 20 years after the end of the Pacific War. And how did that experience shape you?
Oh, it was incredible, because it was like getting a pail of cold water thrown on your head, because everything was completely different. The culture was different. It was very appealing, because you found that the way they were doing things was quite nice. The Japanese were very polite, and they behave in a much different way than you would normally expect to find in America, or for that matter, Europe. And so it was very alluring to study something so different and interesting. And I guess the fact that my father, being German, my mother, Spanish, Puerto Rico, also allowed me to sort of accept a new culture, a new way of doing things.
But it's still interesting, because I think today only 60% of Americans have passports, and then it would have been considerably less. But you are drawn back to Asia. And what did you have in mind when you went back?
When I went back, I wanted to, of course, work in Japan, because I thought that was the place to be. And I got a job with a company called International Research Associates that were doing survey research, consumer survey research. So they would do things like travel research for the Pacific Area Travel Association, or study around Asia for Avon Cosmetics about what is acceptable in Asia for door-to-door selling, that sort of thing. But that then took me to Korea. I spent a year in Korea doing research, and then to Thailand, and finally to Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, I was working for Monsanto Chemical. At that time, Monsanto was best known for Acrolon, the fiber that's used for rugs. But they were launching out into new enterprises. They did things like AstroTurf. I know they're familiar with AstroTurf and other different enterprises. And I was involved in doing consumer research for their high protein drink, which was a joint venture with Hong Kong Soybean. So that was quite interesting. But then after that ended, they wanted me to go back to St. Louis. And I said, no, I want to stay. So I started my own company in Hong Kong, a research company, and then went on to work with Vickers DaCosta, which was a brokerage company. And that took me to Taiwan, where I ended up heading the very first investment management company in Taiwan, International Investment Trust.
And so then in 1987, Sir John Templeton, one of the world's greatest investors, asked you to run the Templeton Emerging Markets Fund. I think you started with 100 million, but you stayed for 30 years. And on your watch, that fund grew to 40 billion invested in 70 countries. So, I mean, how exactly did that opportunity come about? What was it that Sir John Templeton saw in you?
Well, as a sell-side analyst with Vickers DaCosta, I had to go to Nassau, Bahamas, to Life at Key, where Don Templeton lived and worked, to make presentations to him. So I think he realized that here's a guy who's living in Hong Kong, living in an emerging market. He might be the guy to run this new fund. So, of course, at that time when I was hired, I was in Taiwan. So he approached me, and it was a very difficult decision because I was living a king's life in Taiwan, being head of this big organization. But I decided, hey, this might be interesting. So I joined him and I opened up an office in Hong Kong. And that time we only had 6 markets in which we could invest. Most of the emerging markets were not open to foreign investors. There were no stock markets in many places. So we started building the fund and expanding, opening offices in different parts of the world. And then in 1993, Franklin Resources purchased Templeton Asset Management. And that put a rocket under the whole sales efforts for the funds. And we started expanding very, very rapidly and expanding. At one point, we had 16 offices around the world in emerging countries.
I think here's one of his many quotations, but he said once, if we become increasingly humble about how little we know, we may be more eager to search. And I guess my question is, what did he teach you?
That was the big lesson. Precisely what you just said was the big lesson. He always preached humility, open-mindedness, and willingness to accept new ideas. It's really the key, I think, to his success, and one that I really inculcated into my own life.
And how did you start to develop this investment approach that became your hallmark?
Well, of course, a lot depended on what Templeton was doing, because we followed his lead in looking for bargains. And of course, his famous saying was to invest when others are despondently selling, and to sell when others are greedily buying requires the greatest fortitude, but pays the highest rewards. And that's really what it's all about. Willing, of course, to be humble, to look for investment bargains, and to wait for those opportunities when nobody wants to buy, everybody's selling, so that you can buy at low prices.
But we all know what a tricky business it is to invest and achieve consistent results. And I'm wondering what perhaps the most important investment lesson was that you learned in those early days.
The first thing I learned was that you have to really dig and dig and dig, because in those days, emerging markets were not followed by many people. There were not many research organizations or brokers following these markets. So you had to really dig and dig by yourself. And a big part of that was, of course, learning about the people who are running these companies, learning about the culture, learning about the government and how they operate. So I think that was a very important part of the whole process. And one, by the way, that's becoming even more important these days, because even with the tremendous increase in information flow, still the biggest challenge is to know about the people behind the companies.
So I just want to push you on that, because we're becoming a Zoom-adapted world and conference calls being replaced or replacing meetings. But what is it when you go to a country to see the companies concerned that you extract, which you wouldn't otherwise get from a conference call?
There's a thing called body language. When you are facing somebody in reality, you can follow their attitude, their body language, and learn a lot from not only what they're saying, but how they're acting. And more importantly, when you go visit a company, you can look around and see, how people are working, people in the company. I remember visiting one factory in the middle of the workday, and there were no people there. Of course, that raises some questions. It's very important, I think, to be on the ground, despite the fact that we're in this internet world and we have all of these facilities for conference calls. It's very important for us to be on the ground. That's why I believe that after this COVID-19 is over, we will still be doing a lot of travel.
And talking about your investment approach, there's in the industry a lot of discussion about top-down and bottom-up, i.e. using macro inputs to understanding the economy versus companies. Now, I mean, there are some badly managed countries in the emerging market sphere with some good companies there and vice versa. And I'm just intrigued as to how you manage that tension between poor country, good company, and good country, an average company.
That's a big challenge. I mean, one of the first things we look at when we're going into a country is the currency, because at the end of the day, we're U.S. dollar invested. So we've got to know what impact the currency exchange rate will have on the companies in which we invest. Now, in order to assess the currency, we then have to go into payments, bond reserves, central bank discipline, the political environment, etc. But then, let's say we arrive at the conclusion that the currency is going to get weakened with the U.S. dollar. Then we've got to assess what impact that will have on individuals, because a company, let's say, that is exporting may be a big winner with a weak currency. So it may, even with a decline in the local currency, it may be worthwhile for us to invest in that company. So that's the kind of thing we have to look at and consider very, very carefully. It's not easy because, as you know, the political environment can often have an incredible and sudden impact on the currency.
We might come back to some countries a little later on, but let's touch on this post-COVID world that we will be moving into. I mean, firstly, more general question is that shutting down the economies of these emerging countries whose economic sort of journey is so early and where safety nets are so absent, do you think that's been the right policy?
I don't think it has been the right policy to the degree that has been followed. And I also don't believe, unlike the World Bank, or rather the World Health Organization, that one size fits all. For example, let's take South Africa. You've got a young population who are less susceptible to COVID-19. So that should be taken into consideration. In addition, you've got a vast number of people that are unemployed. Before the COVID crisis, they had 30% unemployment. In this kind of environment, the informal economy is very, very important. You cannot lock down the economy to the extent that people cannot work on the street. So I think the fact that people think that you've got to do everything globally and shut down all economies is a wrong approach. In addition, I believe the statistics we're receiving are not accurate. It's only when you can test every single individual in a country and the world that you will really understand how many people have the COVID-19, how many people get sick from COVID-19, how many people die with COVID-19 and without COVID-19. These numbers are not available to us now. So I think a lot of policy decisions are being made that are faulty.
I think there's been a narrative in the West that the world post this will be radically different. But I'm intrigued, when you are talking to managements on the ground in emerging economies, how do they view this and what happens afterwards?
Well, it's, for most companies, a disaster. It's a very, very difficult situation. And it will hurt their earnings. In some cases, it will put companies under. It will make them bankrupt. Because don't forget, they may not have the policies like in the U.S. where the Fed is going to say, we're going to give $1,000, $2,000 to every person in America, or we're going to lend American Airlines so many billions. Many of them don't have that facility. So you're going to have very tough times for many of these companies. Of course, there's an opportunity there because those who have strong balance sheets and survive will do better going forward because they'll have a bigger market share, et cetera. But nevertheless, post-COVID will be quite difficult for many of these companies and countries in emerging markets. But nevertheless, the fact that you've got a young population means that the recovery can come very fast. You can have a very rapid recovery.
And the discussion that is beginning, of course, is that supply chains will be refashioned. And do you think we'll see the sort of made in China appear on fewer labels of things that we buy in the West?
Probably at the consumer level, you probably see fewer made in China. In fact, even before this crisis, you saw that. You saw more like made in Sri Lanka or made in Bangladesh or made in Vietnam, more and more, even made in Turkey, etc. So I think that is going to continue for two reasons. One, the buyers want to diversify their supply chain sources. But secondly, China is moving away from low labor cost manufacturing into more high tech and more value added. So it's a process that was ongoing, but will be accelerated as a result of this crisis.
But I'm also interested in the political angle, in as much as some of these countries are, they have authoritarian regimes. And do you think that those regimes are better suited for dealing with this virus and others that may follow in terms of instructing rather than coercing the population?
Well, I think there's no question in the short term, if you have a one party, one leader dictatorship, you can move fast. The problem with that is that you may be moving fast in the wrong direction, because if you don't make the right decision, it can be disastrous. But there's no question, as demonstrated in China, that they can move pretty fast implementing certain programs. I'm not sure that it is a model for other parts of the world, because as I mentioned, I think one size fits all is probably not the answer. And if you look at America, for example, with the strong states' rights, you'll see how each state is behaving in a different way. And that may be a good thing, because by experimenting with different methods, we may find the best method.
And do you think some of these smaller emerging countries are looking at these two quite different models and being drawn to one as opposed to the other?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the China model is very attractive to many of these countries because they like the idea, of course, particularly if you already have a one-party dictatorship or one party who is ascendant in the political landscape, they would be attracted to the China model. And of course, the strong men who want to get things done would like the China model. So it is quite attractive. I mean, the democratic model is not necessarily the model that many of these countries want to follow, because they realize it's very complicated and very difficult.
Yes, and we all remember Singapore, which we uphold as a fantastic example under Lee Kuan Yew, and that was anything but a democracy.
Exactly. It's interesting. A lot of the countries I visit look at Singapore as a model, and they say, this is something we'd like to follow. And all power to them. If it works, well, why not?
So I wonder, just staying at that macro level, as you look at this developing market universe, whether there are two countries that you really think are well set for the next 20 plus years, and two you really worry about?
I worry about all.
Including our own.
Including the US. But if I take a global view, I can't be too pessimistic about any particular country, because I know how things can change so rapidly. Let's take Venezuela. Venezuela was a very exciting, great investment prospect, and we were investing in Venezuela. And I believe going forward, there's a good possibility that things could change dramatically there. So I don't throw out any particular country from our purview. Of course, if you look at countries on an individual basis, we have to gravitate towards those companies that have, number one, rule of law to some degree a free press, and to some degree a reasonable infrastructure, or at least the ability to build the infrastructure, and a balance sheet we look at the country balance sheet as well as the company balance sheet, that looks reasonably safe. In other words, some good bond reserves, etc.
Have been in South Africa and were shut down because of the current crisis. But do you worry that a country like South Africa has some of the hallmarks of the direction that Zimbabwe took?
Yes, it does have some elements, but it's very, very different in a number of ways. First of all, I consider South Africa as the tale of two countries. You have a very depressed unemployment sector of the society that is in bad shape. And then you have another sector of the society which is doing very well, living at a very high standard with a good infrastructure, very good law and order, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, this was shown to me during the lockdown. The way they were implementing the lockdown was incredible in South Africa. So that's quite different from what we had in Zimbabwe. The other thing is that unlike Zimbabwe, South Africa is more of a heterogeneous society because, first of all, you have Africans of different tribal backgrounds. They're not necessarily speaking the same language and looking at things the same way. You have the white South Africans. You have the Indian South Africans, which are significant. And you have the Cape Malay. In other words, you have a very diverse population, which is a big strength for a country like that, because you bring to bear these cultural advantages, which are very, very good to the country.
That's interesting. Now, I want to just come to the markets as they are currently. We've had an extraordinary rebound, which has many scratching their heads at this sort of the dislocation between the real economy and asset markets. Are you surprised at the rebound? And given that there are going to be industries that don't reopen and incomes that will be cut, what would you expect next?
I was a little disappointed at the rebound in a way, because I was buying as the index was going down. And I was looking at the study that we just completed going back to 1987 of 12 different markets around the world, looking at the bear markets. And we found that the average decline was about 50%. And the average length of time was a little less than 2 years from the top all the way to the bottom. So this market crash, number one, was too short. Number two, didn't go down as much as you would expect, because I think the U.S. index came down by close to 30. So I was a little disappointed. I was saying, gee, I would really like to see this go down further so we can really have a cleaning of the market in a sense of real disaster market, which creates lots of bargains. But no, now the market has come up by, in some cases, 20%. So I only can say that it probably will have another correction. It will probably bounce around the bottom as people realize the true cost of this. Once the financials start coming out of these companies, people will be able to assess what really happened to the balance sheets and to the profit and loss accounts. So we probably will be bouncing along sideways a little bit, maybe further down. So I've kept some powder dry to pick up more opportunities as we go.
So that brings us to the fact that in 2018, you leave Templeton and you found Mobius Capital Partners. Now, for somebody who's been as so successful as you, what is it that you want to achieve with this business?
Well, our idea was that the business, the fund management business, was changing rapidly. With the onset of the index funds, ETFs, the business was becoming more index-oriented. In other words, the challenge was to beat the index rather than have absolute returns. So the trend was for everybody to follow the index. And my partners and I thought, well, let's move away from this and move towards a more private equity-oriented public equity fund type structure, where we look at corporate governance and we consider more of the ESG businesses. In other words, we want to see companies that are doing something good on the environment, something good on the social aspect, but most importantly, good corporate governance. Because without good corporate governance, you're not going to be able to take care of the E and the G. So we wrote a book, Invest for Good, which I hope everybody will pick up. on this podcast. And Invest for Good, we give examples of what we did in the past in terms of improving corporate governance, and most importantly, how that improved the performance of these companies. So that's a tie-in. In other words, Invest for Good in the sense of doing something good for society, but even doing something good for your investors, because they'll make more money in companies that do good.
So ESG, environmental and social governance, you write on your website, activism is not a shareholder privilege. When we invest in a company, we own part of that company. Ownership means responsibility. And my question, Mark, is what are the three things that give you comfort that the company is doing what you want to see?
Well, one of the things we've found is that there's so many companies who are amenable to listening. More and more, when we approach companies, they're willing to sit down with us and listen to what we're saying about their ownership structure, about their environmental record, about their social policies, and so forth. So that is the good news. But of course, that only represents maybe half of the companies that we approach. The many others are not interested. So in answer to your question, we found a lot of reception for that. And part of that is because the companies themselves want to improve and want to see their stock price improve. And one of the things we emphasize with them when we sit down with them is, hey, look, your stock price is down. We can help you get it up if you deal with us on the ESG issues. The other thing is that ESG has definitely penetrated corporate cultures around the world. People are now very aware of the word sustainability. They may not fully understand what it means, but they definitely know what it is, and it's something that they have to pay attention to. And that's a big, big improvement over previous years.
Is there a danger, though, as we sit in the West with our great expectations about reducing carbon footprint, that those countries that are earlier in their development, and maybe like China and India have 70% of their electric power generated from coal, kind of say, well, aren't you being a bit hypocritical? You've had your growth and now you can afford to be a little bit more relaxed.
Definitely. I mean, you always get that from people in the emerging countries. They say, look, we have to have power and our source is coal. What do we do? Where can we go going forward from that? But the good news is that I would say without exception, governments and companies around the world are aware of their need to change, because their own countries are being polluted. One of the implications of pollution, particularly with this COVID-19, is respiratory problems. In India, this is a big issue. And one of the reasons why, with the lockdown, the number of respiratory problems is going down, because the pollution is going down. So people at the local level are definitely aware of it, and they don't necessarily have to be lectured from the developed world. They are quite aware of the need for them to do it themselves.
Well, Mark, I want to move on to a few more general questions, if I may. What do you think is the most common mistake investors make?
I think the common mistake is listening to others. And I'm guilty of that as much as anybody else. I mean, you don't live in isolation. You are surrounded by information and you are influenced by this information. But the big mistake is that people listen to what their friends say, what their neighbors say. They pick up the newspaper and somebody says, oh boy, we're headed for a disaster, and they start selling and so forth and so on. So I would say the biggest problem is that, because let's face it, the markets are a psychological and sociological phenomenon. And that's what people have got to keep in mind.
So we touched on currency a little bit earlier, but on the Money Maze podcast logo, we have the dollar, sterling, yen, and euro. And I just wondered if you were to cast your mind for 5 years forward, maybe 10, do you think all four will exist? And if not, what might have replaced them?
I think going forward, we can't expect the currencies as we now know them to survive. You can see that pound sterling used to be like the US dollar. It was the global currency, and it fell by the wayside. Gold used to be the common currency, and that fell by the wayside. So I think going forward, we're going to have much more of a digital world and a digital currency, not necessarily a Bitcoin or anything like that, but perhaps the currency backed by some believable and credible medium of exchange, like gold. So that would be something that I could see going forward that would develop and be very popular.
And would you expect the RMB, the renminbi, Chinese currency, to be there, A? And B, would you be surprised if the euro doesn't exist in its current form?
I think the euro will exist longer than a lot of people think because it's been so successful. I know the euro has been criticized by almost everybody, but I think it's been a resounding success because it brought Europe together. It's so convenient for people in Europe, and it's just really been very, very successful. I'm not saying that European Central Bank is the greatest success, but anyway, the currency has been pretty good. But I think there is a possibility of the renminbi becoming a global currency. You must remember that China probably has the biggest gold reserves in the world. Nobody really knows what the amount is, but if they say the renminbi is backed by gold, the credibility would go up. The thing that's holding the renminbi back now is it's not freely traded. Once that changes, then you'll see the renminbi come up.
Let's just, if we may, return to gold. For John Maynard Keynes, it was a barbarous relic, and for others, it's the only protection against untrustworthy governments that print excessively for their own salvation. Where do you stand on this, and how much gold would you want to have in a portfolio?
Well, I've been recommending that people have at least 10% in gold, and some people, like in India, they probably have more because they really believe in gold. So I think that's important to have as sort of a safety valve, so to speak. But to be fair to Keynes, he was living in a world in which there was a possibility of central bank discipline, where the central banks would not issue currency at the whim of the politicians, which is not the situation now. So he called the gold a barbarous relic on the basis of the fact that central banks could issue strong currencies and be credible. But that has changed. And I think that's something that people have to remember.
We haven't spoken about the Middle East, but in the last 10 weeks, Brent crude has gone from $60 to $15, a 75% decline, possibly with the greatest volatility that any of us can remember. And we have these Middle East countries trying to transition from being dependent almost exclusively on oil to developing new industries, but they need oil revenues to get there. How does this play out?
I think it plays out in the sense that they are now going to have to realize that they cannot depend on oil. They've got to depend on other sources of income. Of course, many of these countries have already diversified their asset base by investing in stock markets in the West. As you know, Saudi Arabia and all these rich countries have quite a lot of resources around the world, hotels, investments in many, many different areas. So I think that's the first thing they've got to realize. They can't depend upon oil. The good news in emerging countries is that by and large, this oil price has been a boon to countries like India, China, and many of these oil importers, with a few exceptions like Nigeria, who depend upon oil. Many of the emerging countries are going to benefit from this low oil price.
I know you spent a lot of time in India and Turkey. Would you say they're right at the top of your list of countries that you think are optimally placed for the next decade?
India is definitely up there, along with China. And we have Turkey in our portfolio as well. But India is particularly interesting at this stage.
And just help me, why particularly at this stage, other than the oil dividend?
Because they have the opportunity now to take the next step and garner some of the manufacturing capacity that wasn't in China, is in China, and taking over on some of these products and services that China has been supplying up to now.
And you're optimistic on China, but should President Trump be re-elected President Trump, do you think the rancor that was there pre-COVID and tensions will re-escalate?
I think they're there and they will continue. I think China realizes that they cannot continue the policy of consumer good exports to the U.S. and depend on that market. So they've already diversifying away from that. A lot of the manufacturers in China, by the way, are moving into other countries and continuing to export to the U.S. because if they're not exporting from China, they can still get into the U.S. market. So the bottom line is that China is becoming more of a consumer-led economy like the U.S. and is focusing more on value-added products and technology. So I think they will be able to do just that. And I think it's a good thing for China and the rest of the world, the fact that they're moving into other markets.
Mark, on the subject of philanthropy, I understand you've been very generous to your former alma mater, Boston University. Can you talk about how you try and maximize the impact of your generosity?
If you talk to anybody who wants to give money away, they'll find that it's very difficult to decide how to do it, when to do it, etc. I owed something to Boston University or the scholarship people who gave me the chance to invest at that university, so I decided to pay back. And then also I started a scholarship for my high school in Long Island, New York. Every year I give 2 prizes for entrepreneurship and 2 prizes for the arts. So I'm still continuing to look at my different opportunities to do various kinds of benefits to people around the world. But please, nobody come to me for money. I don't have any now.
Understood. But just staying with youth, we have quite a lot of young folks thinking about their future who listen to the show. 2 pieces of advice for the young.
First of all, sit down and really look at your life and look at what you love the most. Don't worry about making money or doing something that your mother wants or your father wants or your friends want. Think about what you like and what has made you the happiest. Then decide on which occupation which would best fit those likes, those things that you love. Then you'll be on the right path to have an occupation that you really love and do well. Because if you love something, you definitely will do well by it. And by the way, doing well doesn't mean making a lot of money.
So Mark, you must have met, eaten, traveled with so many interesting people. But if you could have dinner with just one person who's alive today, who would it be?
There's so many people that I would love to have dinner with. But perhaps I'd love to have dinner with the Prime Minister of India, Mr. Modi.
Okay, well, Mr. Modi, if you're listening, you need to make a date in the diary for Mr. Mobius. But Mark, normally as we wrap up the show, we ask our guests what's their favorite book. But I'm going to take a slightly different tack here. And I just want to share with the listeners, one paragraph, which you'll know, and it says, I choked on roasted camel's meat, sheep's eyeball, guinea pig, and dined on scorpions. I'd hobnobbed with princes, potentates, and pashas, and been swindled in souks so labyrinthine, I'm amazed I ever found my way out. Well, of course, that is from your book, Passport to Profits, and I hope that our listeners will go and buy it and enjoy it. Great. Mark, in all your travels, you've had some really interesting experiences. Just share with our listeners, please, what was the most scary one that you encountered?
Well, one of them was we were in Manila when there was a coup attempt, and I was at the Intercontinental Hotel in Makati, and the bullets were flying, and one of the bullets came through the window. Luckily, no one was hurt. So we had to get out of there somehow. So our friends called in a helicopter to land on the roof of the Intercontinental. And so we got up to the roof and hopped into this helicopter. And I was sitting next to the pilot. I looked at him. He didn't look more than 12 years old. Filipinos, Asians generally look younger. But I couldn't believe it. I looked at him. I said, wait a minute. Is this a good idea? And of course, I don't know whether you've ever been in a helicopter that was taking off from a tall building. What happens is that as you go off the building roof, there's a downdraft. So the helicopter falls. So that was another scare, but we were able to get out anyway.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm quite happy I didn't share that one with you. So Mark, I've read that you have given 4 pieces of advice. Keep learning, keep an open mind, be curious, and keep humble. Anything you'd add to that list?
No, that's it. That summarizes it. I think that's what we really got to focus on.
Mark, I think you are an inspiration to everyone, and it's just been a delight listening to you today, and thank you so much for being on the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Thanks again.
That's great, Mark. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The Money Maze podcast is free, and if you liked what you heard, please write a review on iTunes or Google Play to help others discover the show. If you'd like to keep up with our work, please search The Money Maze Podcast on LinkedIn, at Money Maze Podcast on Facebook, or at Money Maze Podcast on Instagram. Finally, you'll find other information at our website, www.moneymazepodcast.com. Until next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.